Hello and welcome in.
Because he shows them the magic and mystery of science in everyday living.
On Science Mixtape on Soho Radio.
Hello and welcome indeed. You are listening to Science Mixtape on Soho Radio, and we have got an action-packed show coming up for you this week. Stay tuned if you want to hear how to make an ocean in a bottle and find out more about a really fascinating polyphasic sleep experiment from the experimenter himself. Yes, this week I am joined by our guest Akshat, who is a former chemist who spent his PhD working on a molecule with antifungal and anti-cancer properties from an ocean-dwelling sponge, no less. I'm going to get Akshat to tell you the name of that molecule because I struggle to pronounce it. What was that molecule?
It's called microsclerodermin A.
Microsclerodermin A. There you go, because there are many versions of microsclerodermin.
Nine.
But perhaps his most interesting achievement is that for a whole year for his PhD, he slept no more than 4.5 hours in every 24. This is phenomenal, and we are going to find out more about how he achieved this later in the show. Coming up, we also have our regular 3-Minute Science from Kyle Major. And if you want to be joining us to make an ocean in a bottle, all you're going to need is a large plastic bottle, a lot of olive oil, some food colouring and some water. That will also be happening halfway through the show. Now, Akshat, you have chosen the songs for today. Could you please tell me what you want to start with and why?
Adele, Set Fire to the Rain.
And why have you chosen this one?
Well, so I have the 6 songs that'll come up have some sort of a chemistry theme, you know, chemical reactions. Fire is a pretty, pretty interesting chemical reaction. But there's a side to you.
News. This week, I couldn't quite believe how perfectly the science news fitted with Science Mixtape, because last week, regular listeners will know, we had on Mark Dybul talking about his research on modern hunter-gatherers, and this week we have Akshat talking about sleep. And the science news as of yesterday was that our ancestors had less sleep than we do. So it was research done on modern hunter-gatherers, specifically 3 tribes, the Hazda of Tanzania, the San of Namibia and the Tsimoni of Bolivia. And they were being studied as because they live without electricity, without sort of modern media, as a way of looking at how naturally we may have slept 10,000 years ago. And they recorded the sleeping habits of 94 people within these 3 tribes for over 1,100 days using ACTI watches, which sort of measure your movement, measure your sleep rhythms, and found that overall, on average, very similar patterns across all 3 groups, and they slept maybe about 6.5 hours a night. So this is interesting because there's a lot of research at the moment saying that we sleep less than we used to, and, you know, average sleep rates are falling. Is that not right, Akshat?
Yeah, I think what they have done is pretty interesting, mostly because most of the sleep research that we do today is self-reported data. So people are asked in surveys to say how much they've slept, or even if they're done via labs, they are still told to go home and make a note of how much they've slept. And that data is not as reliable as using an ACT graph, so which will tell you for real how much someone slept. But I would still think 94 people, even though it's across 3 different tribes, is just not enough to make the bold conclusion that the researchers are trying to make out.
Absolutely. It's always good to be skeptical. But it is quite interesting because We have had data from, say, like the American Sleep Foundation that says, you know, in the last 50 years, the average amount of sleep has dropped from 9 hours to less than 7. And, you know, 30% of Americans get less than 6 hours of sleep. So it does seem, if we look at modern data, that there is this trend of sleep becoming less and less and less. And we're blaming it on our, you know, busy modern lives and having artificial light.
Well, it turns out that even the modern data is conflicting. And we can talk about that later on when I tell you more about the myth of sleeping enough.
Excellent, very forward there. So anyway, I thought that was pretty cool, looking at modern hunter-gatherers and how much they slept. What caught your eye this week, Akshat?
So one of the stories that caught my eye was this one about how there are two animals that can, to a certain extent, resist cancer. And these two animals, one of them is a favorite for many people, is the elephant.
Oh, yes.
And what the researchers found was that when you look at the genome of of a modern elephant, there are 20 copies of a gene called TP53, which is known to be known to repair DNA damage. And DNA damage, as you may know, is one of the easiest ways to get cancer, or is one of the necessary steps to get cancer.
Yeah, damage to sort of the parts of the DNA that code for cell replication and the controls of the cell cycle.
Indeed, and yeah, and that can cause it to grow uncontrollably and then become a tumor. So elephants seem to have 20 copies of that, whereas humans only have one.
They have 20 copies?
Yeah.
What, they just got like spare ones lying around?
Yeah. Well, at some, you know, evolution might have given them some advantage. So unlike humans, elephants reproduce still very late in life. Their natural lifespan is about 60 years, whereas the natural lifespan of humans before modern medicine came around was about 35 years. And so...
Wow, can I just say that's a testament to modern medicine now that the average life is sort of, you know, 70 to 80 years, more than doubled.
Indeed, indeed. And so it's probably that there was an evolutionary pressure to get them to have genes that would protect the DNA repair mechanism.
Yeah, because as you get older, it tends to be that maybe having children at an older age leads to more genetic difficulties.
Indeed. Yeah, and women or humans, most mammals go through menopause, so they will not reproduce after a certain age because of one of those problems. But elephants, on the other hand, reproduce very late into life.
They
don't have menopause.
What?
At least as far as we know.
No pressures of a biological clock then.
Indeed.
Oh, great.
And the other animal is the naked mole rat, which is a very weird creature, and maybe most people don't know about it. It's nearly blind, it lives underground, lives on little oxygen, little food, and never develops cancer. Or at least never, as far as we know.
Wow.
Yeah. So, and you know, the researchers have been trying to study the naked mole rat for a very long time. But more recently, they found one thing that might be helping it to resist cancer. And that's a chemical which, you know, as a chemist, even I find hard to pronounce. So I'm just going to pronounce it and, you know, people can make up their mind. Is hyaluronan, which is in between cells. And what it does is, as you said, it stops the unregulated growth of cells and stops any, even if the DNA is broken within cells, from going berserk into becoming a tumor.
It's kind of like an extra reinforcement around the cells.
Yeah, like a bouncer.
Yeah. You cannot pass. You cannot multiply.
That's it.
That's so cool. The naked mole rat is fascinating. I have only ever seen one on sort of a David Attenborough documentary. But yeah. I do encourage all listeners, if you do not know what a naked mole rat looks like, go and Google it now. Because they're sort of pink and hairless. And like they have these sort of weird fronds that come from the front of their noses. And they just, I mean, I've got to say it, they look pretty ugly. They are not nice, cute, fluffy, ratty, moldy things.
Yeah. Some experiments on naked mole rats in my undergraduate. And it was to see which one was submissive and which was dominant in their colony. So I would sit there just looking at 30 naked mole rats just going around. And the way you figure out is when two like come together, the other like ends up like backing away slowly because it's realised the other is a bit more dominant. And then the dominant one just climbs over it. And I just sitting there charting which one is the most dominant. It was like number 18.
You climbed over many mole rats today.
Exactly.
So this is absolutely fascinating. So they've looked at these two different animals and found two different mechanisms for which they seem to resist getting cancer.
Yeah.
And in particularly with the naked mole rat, is there any way that this chemical hyaluronan, could we sort of be developing something along those lines? Is there any way that we could use this information within to help humans?
Perhaps, and this is always the case, right? You're trying to find these mechanisms in nature so that you can try and replicate them in humans in some way. But there is no way yet we can do that. That doesn't mean we can't ever, but there is hope.
Yeah, a direction for future research.
Sure.
In other news, Amna, what caught your eye this week?
So there are many uses, weird uses of antibiotics that worsen drug resistance. So again, actually I wrote a really interesting article about this for Quartz. But people don't really realise, I wanted to know, how close are we to getting to this really scary world where
antibiotics no longer work?
Yeah, and you know, things like from a really simple surgery to, you know, things that are so standard to get rid of today. I mean, would we be alive in that kind of world, do you think?
Well, I mean, it's one of the things, going back to what you said about modern medicine, is that, you know, the fundamental reason why we've been able to double human lifespan across the world is one of the fundamental reasons is antibiotics. And bacteria evolve and they get used to the antibiotics we use if we don't use them properly. And if they become resistant to all the antibiotics we have, we are in big trouble.
Definitely.
Yeah.
And there are pretty weird uses to antibiotics. Which one? Because I think like beekeeping, now I'm definitely going to pronounce this one wrong. It's
oxytetracycline.
Well, close enough. It's used to starve off like infections in bee larvae. And it can also destroy entire colonies.
Yeah, it's used in horticulture where it's used for fending infections in pear and apple orchards.
God, I didn't know we had to defend pears and apples from bacteria with antibiotics.
Well, before humans or any animals walked this planet, bacteria were the things that existed here, and they have existed forever. So, you know, they are actually fairly powerful. And so other uses are alcohol production.
Now, this is scary. I mean,
your vodka probably was treated with antibiotics. Well, the stuff that made your vodka.
But alcohol is supposed to be really good at killing bacteria.
Yeah, but not while the alcohol is being created. So the fermentation process has yeast in it.
So that you don't contaminate it.
Indeed, yeah. And so the idea is that during the distillation process, where you concentrate alcohol, you will kill the bacteria. And that's how they've assumed. But recent studies by the Food and Drug Administration in the US have shown that actually some of those antibiotics get through. They don't actually, you know, it's the antibiotics that are getting through, and that are then, you know, along with the bacteria that can consume that when you throw away a drink or something, that's causing antibiotic resistance.
They're just sort of out in the world.
Yeah.
Wow.
And the final one, I'd say, is just a really funny one, and that's to do with stopping the buildup of barnacles. And, you know, if...
Is this a common problem?
If you are a sailor, it is a very common problem. You have to make sure that your hull, the ship's hull, is clear of barnacles, because
you
barnacles
want it to be streamlined, yes.
Indeed, exactly. And barnacles in general can start rotting or, you know, consuming things or just destroying your hull.
Eroding away at the boat. Exactly. Yeah.
And so what happens is bacteria form biofilms. Some bacteria form biofilms. So there are these extracellular matrix in which you have microbes sitting in, and they're just sticky things on which barnacles can sit. So they put antibiotic in paint, and it's called anti-fouling paint, that kills the bacterial biofilms, and that's why it stops the barnacle buildup.
Wow. So from apples and pears to barnacles on a ship, we are using antibiotics for everything, it sounds like.
And there are no alternatives, as far as you know. So someone needs to come up with those if you want to avoid going back to the 19th century, at least in terms of medical research.
Yeah, indeed. Wow. What is our next song going to be?
It's 15 Steps by Radiohead. And the story behind that is that when I first started my PhD and we charted out the program to make up the molecule that I was trying to make up, it was going to be 15 steps long.
Oh,
something else happened in your PhD that we've slightly mentioned, and that was that in your final year, you kind of stopped sleeping.
Well, it was my first year, and kind of didn't quite stop sleeping, although I would have loved to do that, and I'm sure pretty much, you know, a lot of people would love to do that. What I did was I could not get away with 8 hours of sleep. If I slept less, I was groggy. If I slept more, I was groggy. And I didn't have a productive day. And I wanted to fix that in some way. But I also wanted more time to do lots of fun things that were happening at university while not sacrificing on all the lab time I had to put in.
So you wanted to fit in work and play and get rid of some sleep.
Yep. And what?
That sounds like everyone's dream at university.
Yeah. And so I came across this American inventor called Buckminster Fuller.
Also a famous chemist.
Also a famous chemist. Well, inventor and designer and all sorts of things. He's just a polymath. He came up with this schedule, which was published in Time magazine in 1943, where he slept only for 30 minutes every 6 hours. That was 2 hours in every 24 hours when put together. And I was wow, hugely inspired. I thought, man, if that guy can do it, surely I can. I can try. And so I looked up all these people who were trying to do or repeat what Buckminster Fuller did. And it was, at least online, a whole evolved field. There were forums, people talking about polyphasic sleeping and their techniques and their tricks and their experiences.
So that's what it's called when you're sleeping sort of intermittently throughout the 24 hours. It's called polyphasic.
Right, yes. In many phases. That's it.
And for those that don't know, the way that we normally sleep, typically, you know, one big sleep at night, that's monophasic because you're just having one sleeping time within your 24 hours.
Which is right. And it's not that we always were monophasic slow. Before electricity was invented or even candles, people used to sleep at night, but they used to have segmented sleep. So they used to sleep 4 hours, then get up for an hour or two, and then go back to sleep for another 4 hours.
Yeah, I heard someone saying that this was also sort of why we have midnight masses. You know, the monks would sort of sleep, wake up, have a mass, because everyone did just wake up in the middle of the night.
That's
and then
it.
Go to sleep again. It wasn't like some arduous, torturous alarm clock event.
That is right. That is right. So what I tried to do was try to repeat what Buckminster Fuller did. But within the first 36 hours of doing this, and I was doing it with a friend who was my housemate, we literally hit a wall. And it was a wall in a sense that, I could not stay awake at night after those first 36 hours. And my housemate couldn't wake up after the 30-minute nap.
Oh, wow.
And so we decided to, well, my housemate decided he's not going to do it. I said I want to do it. So we decided to, I decided to move on to an easier sleep schedule, which is called the Everyman Sleep Schedule, where I slept 3.5 hours at night and then took 3 20-minute naps in the day.
I'm not sure that sounds that much easier.
It's easier than sleeping only 30 minutes every 6 hours.
That's true. That's true. So where did the Everyman schedule come from?
This came from like people on the internet having decided a bunch of different schedules. So there are other schedules. So Dymaxion is what the Buckminster Fuller schedule was called. Everyman is the one I described. There's something called the Uberman schedule where you sleep 20 minutes every 4 hours.
Rather than just sleeping in your Uber on the way home.
So that's what I did. It took me 3 weeks to adjust to it. And I was pretty zombie-ish in those 3 weeks.
Yeah, tell me, what was it like?
Sleep deprivation is hard. You get naps, but that's okay. And in those 3 weeks, you are not functioning at your cognitive best, mildly put. And so you're not the best communicator, you're not the best thinker, you're not the best person to handle chemicals, sensitive chemicals. And so those 3 weeks I had to struggle through. But once those 3 weeks were over, it was pretty good.
So literally just one day you woke up and you were kind of fine again?
Not one day. It was a gradation. So I was getting close to it, but it took me 3 weeks to actually feel, yes, now I'm ready and I can do this and I can feel very good all through the day having done this schedule.
That's incredible. What would you say was the hardest point? Was it sort of end of week one? Was it middle of week two before you kind of got to that stage?
That's a good question. It's been like 6 years. So I don't know if I can quite remember what was the hardest point. But I think the one hardest thing that was true all through the year that I did the experiment was to have the motivation to get up the next day after only having slept 3.5 hours. And I really needed to tell myself, what are the things that I'm going to do tomorrow which are going to excite me and want me to do this crazy sleep experiment?
Yeah, I mean, I find it hard enough to get up after sort of 6 or 7 hours. I love my bed. So that worked? You were able to incentivize yourself every day to get up?
Yeah, yeah. And I think I've carried on that till date. I, you know, before I sleep, I kind of think about what I did in the day, and then I think about what I'm going to do the next day. I don't have to motivate myself anymore, but it's a very good way of reflecting on the days it's gone and life in general.
Yeah, that's awesome.
We have a joke in the office about Akshat, which I don't know if I should just reveal on live radio, where he's just like, really in a brilliant way, just kind of measures a lot of aspect of your life that I think would just go over all of the rest of our heads. But it just makes me think, like, you did a recent article on this man that took a picture every 30 seconds throughout his entire day, and he felt like, you know, he was living a lot longer than anyone else his own age. I wonder whether you, just being so self-reflective and like trying to measure different aspects and wanting to improve, like being almost robotic about very simple human things like sleep, means that you're living your life very differently.
Well, I think the other way to look at it is not to say robotic, but to be more human, because sleep is the most human of activities, and most people really don't understand it. Even researchers are, you know, really only scratching the surface when it comes to sleep. And so,
can you really say it's the most human of all activities, though, when most animals sleep?
Well, most human, I mean, it's not robotic in any sense.
Oh, yeah, yeah, as in a living, it's a living requirement, it's a fundamental.
Exactly. It is a fundamental thing. And so me trying to experiment with it has been more sort of an exploration of what it is to be an animal.
Yes, absolutely. And what, other than sort of motivating yourself to get up after your 3.5 hours, what else was challenging about this?
So I didn't drink much tea or coffee. And so,
I could feel listeners go at home going, how did he survive without coffee and without sleep?
It was just a habit that my mum used to drink a lot of tea, and she was addicted to it. She recently gave up, by the way, after whatever, 45 years of drinking tea.
Congratulations, Akshat's mum.
So she was addicted to it. She used to have headaches when she didn't get her tea. And so I just got sort of, I just developed this repulsion to tea. And then coffee. So I never used to drink tea and coffee very much. So that was easy to give up. And I also gave up alcohol for the whole year.
Oh my God.
Wow.
That's even more self, what's the word, self-restraint.
But again, it's not like, so I just come from India, and alcohol is not such a big part of culture in India. Yes, we went out drinking, but it was never the kind of binge drinking I saw at universities here.
But you were at university when you did this.
I was at university, and in some way it was a reaction. It was like 6 months, 9 months into living in Britain. It was a reaction to, oh God, this country drinks too much.
That's amazing.
I've just tweeted Akshat's article, and it has absolutely brilliant photos of him just being asleep on a bench in a lecture. I just love how doubled over you are.
So these 3 20-minute naps, could you just take them whenever?
No, so they were kind of 4 hours apart. There was some flexibility in 4, 4.5, maybe 5 hours, but usually they were 4 hours apart. And I could take them wherever. So I could, if I had my earplugs to block the noise, and I could put my head down and block light, I could sleep pretty much anywhere. And I was warm enough, I could sleep anywhere.
That's pretty impressive. So you're now very good at falling asleep on cue.
Yeah.
Brilliant. Well, we want to ask you listeners, what helps you get to sleep and what helps you to relax? Because at the end of the show, we'll be playing the song that was declared the most relaxing music ever by the British Academy of Sound Therapy back in 2011. So if you tweet us in what you think gets you to relax and what helps you to fall asleep, what were your top tips apart from the earplugs and staying warm to help you fall asleep? Was it just be really tired and only sleep 3.5 hours at night?
So the other thing I did was if I could have my earphones with me, I had these sort of in-ear phones which blocked other noise. I used to listen to Max Richter, and he's just a sort of a classical musician who does a good mix of classical and sort of modernish music, and it's just very relaxing. And I used to listen, I had like a 25 minute set order of his music that I used to play, and that used to put me to sleep instantly.
Incredible. Well, I'll be interested to see what you make of our sleep relaxing song at the end of the show. But now it's time for some more music. Before I ask you what your song's going to be, just to say, right after the song, we'll go straight into our 3 minute science, which this week is from Jack Devlin, who is working on a way to measure the how round an electron is. So that's coming up after the next song. What is the next song going to be?
So this is me trying to find a chemistry theme in a Bollywood song. I don't listen to very many Bollywood songs despite being Indian, but this one I love, and it's called Liquid Dance by A.R. Rahman.
From Slumdog Millionaire.
Hi, my name is Jack Devlin. I'm a postdoc at Imperial College London, and I work on an experiment to measure the size of the electron's electric dipole moment.
So what is the electron's electric dipole moment?
Well, it's basically, you can think about it a bit like the electron's shape. So we know that an electron has an electric charge, so it behaves a bit like a point charge. But is it possible that it has a more complicated interaction with an electric field? For instance, could it have an interaction which depends on the direction that the electron has in the electric field, not just its position, say?
So it's a bit more like a magnet?
Yeah, so you can think about it a bit like a magnet. We know that if you hold a magnet in a magnetic field, it takes more energy for you to hold the magnet in one orientation in the magnetic field than it does in the other. And an electron could have a similar property, but in an electric field. And that property, that ability to have a different energy depending on which way round you have it in the field, that would be its electric dipole moment.
You say it could have. Do you know whether or not it does have this electric dipole moment?
Right. So far I've kind of been speaking as if this thing really exists, but every time anyone has ever tried to measure this property of the electron, it's always come out as zero. So it's always been consistent with it not having its shape, it just being a point charge. People have sort of been doing these measurements for 50 years now. So you might wonder why on earth people still bother, since it seems to always be zero. But it's a really interesting thing to keep measuring, because it's really intimately connected with time reversal asymmetry in the laws of physics. So do you need a different set of laws, or do the laws of physics change in some way when you reverse the direction of time? Almost all of the laws of physics are symmetric under time reversal symmetry. But if we've measured an electron electric dipole moment, that would be new evidence that some particular laws of physics, the laws that give the electron this property, aren't symmetric under time reversal.
So that's like if you would wind the clock backwards, it wouldn't look the same as it would, as it normally does with the clock going forward.
That's right, yeah, that's what time reversal asymmetry would be. So, yes, in a lot of physical processes, like two balls colliding, you can use the same set of equations to describe the balls coming together, colliding and flying apart, as you would if you were to reverse the video and sort of show them coming in back together, colliding and going back in there with opposite velocities. But if we were to measure a non-zero value for the dipole moment, if the electron was to have a shape, then that would tell us that the laws of physics aren't time reversal symmetric.
3 minute science.
3 minute science.
And thank you very much to Kyle Major for doing that. You are back to Science Mixtape, and we are ready to make our ocean in a bottle. Now, why are we making an ocean in a bottle when we've mainly been talking about sleep, you might ask?
Well, we just played a song that was called Liquid Dance. And so this is us trying to make liquids dance
absolutely,
in a bottle.
Absolutely. And also, Akshat got his molecule that he was studying his PhD on from the ocean. But hang on, make sure, listeners, you've got your bottle, your large bottle, and what's the first thing that we're going to do?
So we have a bottle of water in which we have added some ink to make it blue.
Or blue food dye you could add as well.
Yeah, and so we're adding about 500 ml of water to a 1 liter bottle.
Excellent pouring skills from Akshat here in the studio. Here we go. It's my fault. I should have brought my funnel. To make it easier, if you've got a funnel at home, I do recommend you use that. That's great. So you want it to fill like a third of your 1 litre bottle. And then you're going to top up the rest of the bottle with olive oil. Why olive oil, you may ask? Well, olive oil and water do not mix. They have fundamentally different properties. I'm going to get Akshat actually explain why.
So one of the reasons why oil and water don't mix is because the molecules that make up oil, they are hydrophobic, which is they hate water. And water is H2O, so it has two molecules of hydrogen and one of oxygen, whereas oil has lots and lots of molecules of carbon along with hydrogen and oxygen. But just the way the chemicals that make up oil are made up, they find themselves being repulsed by water molecules. And so when you mix the two liquids in this one bottle, you'll see that they form two distinct layers. And so your olive oil would be the yellow golden color that it is, and then your water would be the dyed blue color. And once you have that, which we have now ready in front of us, that actually, it looks so beautiful,
doesn't it? It's so beautiful because of the way when I brought it in, it was obviously sort of trapping some air in the oil that was then mixing in the water, and all that air is slowly rising. We've got some amazing bubbles rising up through our oil at the moment, because obviously it's much more viscous than water and they travel more slowly.
Yeah, I mean, if you were doing this not in a plastic bottle that can't be heated, if you could heat it up, it would form a lava lamp, because you'd get hot water trying to get to the oily layer, because hot water will try and expand and it'll enter the oily layer, and then the oily layer would be pushed down and you get this lava lamp. But right now we're going to make an ocean.
And right now we're going to make an ocean. So you take your bottle with the water and the oil, and you're just going to gently tilt it from side to side, and you will see an amazing wave forming as the oil and the water move along and the water pushes the oil around. Really good way to kind of study wave formation and currents. Very simple, but beautiful. And you said that you got your molecule that you were studying on from a sponge. Now, did someone sort of know that this sponge was really good at fighting fungus and cancer, or was it just sort of luck?
No, so one of the ways to look at chemistry is to say that they are fundamentally, everything around you is fundamentally made up of atoms of different elements. Mm-hmm. And you could arrange these atoms in different ways to make up different stuff. But the number of arrangements for these atoms is infinite, literally, it's near infinity as you can think of. But the actual stuff that can exist is limited. And so what chemists do is to find what are the ways in which these elements and atoms can be combined and can form molecules that are actually useful to humans, is to just look at what nature does, because nature has been making chemicals for billions of years. And it's a way of being inspired.
Yeah, so a really good example of what you just said, how the same kind of atoms just being rearranged differently creates different things. What we eat, fats, carbohydrates and proteins, have essentially made up of the three same basic elements, aren't they? Carbon, hydrogen, oxygen.
Yeah.
Maybe with a little bit of nitrogen in there.
Well, carbon, hydrogen, on oxygen for carbohydrates. And then when you have, yes, proteins, you have a little bit of nitrogen in there. And then if you add phosphorus, those are literally five elements that make up most of life.
Wow. So carry on, sorry.
So, yeah. So once you have these chemists looking at nature for inspiring molecules, they go to herbs on earth, on the ground, and then they look at things in the ocean. So ocean chemistry has been evolving for much longer than terrestrial or on the earth ground chemistry has been evolving. And so ocean sponges are a really good place to find weird molecules that may or may not be, well, that may be helpful in some way to humans. They may, in my case, have antifungal and anti-cancer properties.
Wow. So you literally just kind of trawl around through the ocean, scooping stuff up and seeing if it might help us.
Yeah, yeah. There are a few more steps involved. You have to crush them, and then you have to treat them with other chemicals, and then you have to isolate the different, because once you, within a sponge, there would be hundreds and hundreds of molecules or thousands of molecules of different kinds. And so you have to separate all those out, and you have to find and you have to characterize each one of them. And then you have to have enough of them to figure out whether they will have any biological activity on the kinds of things we are looking for, antifungal, anti-cancer. So they found that in my case, in the 90s, this molecule called microsclerodermin, it's a whole family, about nine molecules, A to I, which have these properties. And so we tried to make them in the lab so that we could then make enough of that. You don't want to destroy the ocean. And anyway, if you do, you're going to get very small quantities of it. Mm. So why not make it in the lab?
Absolutely. Well, what song will we be having next?
Keeping to the chemistry theme, let's have Ion by Placebo.
Final section of the show, something else very interesting that Akshat's been kind of experimenting with is lucid dreams.
So these are the kinds of dreams where you are aware that you are dreaming, and if you become better at lucid dreaming, you can also control what you do in your dream. And there are many techniques to do it. One of them is to keep a dream diary whenever you dream, you wake up. The first thing you do is you note down what you were dreaming about. And then once you start doing that for a while and you start remembering your dreams a little more, you then try and think about something that you want to dream about. And you do that concentrate on it, meditate on it or whatever. And that can be a way for you to fall into a lucid dream that you want to experience, and then you want to enjoy within your dream to control what you do.
And so you've been practicing doing this. What kind of lucid dreams have you managed to control?
So not quite practicing. What happened is while I was doing my sleep experiment, a lot of people online used to say that they experienced lucid dreaming just because they were napping that many number of times. So because you slept four or five times a day, which is more than the one time a person sleeps in a day, people had more chances to dream. And because they were waking up after a short period, because that's what you do in a nap, you had more chances to remember the dreams you had. So that's why more people were remembering that they were actually enjoying a lucid dream. Mm. And so I experienced one where I used to play Assassin's Creed, which is a game, video game, and I used to, I played that for hours and hours one week, and then I had a dream where I was in the video game, in the virtual world. There were no people to interact or kill, but I could sort of do all the things that the assassin could do, you know, and choose the direction where I wanted to go in the virtual world. And that was an amazing dream. I've never forgotten it.
Oh, that's so cool. I see what you mean about, like, having lucid dreams when you're napping, because I don't think I've ever had a lucid dream that I could control. But the only dreams I remember are the ones when I've sort of woken up and then gone back to sleep in a drowsy way. Like, you know, if the sunlight's woken me up too early and then I'm like, no, I can have another hour in bed. That's when I have, like, a really vivid dream.
Yeah.
Haven't quite got to controlling them yet, but yeah. Maybe I need to start a dream diary.
And there's also, you know, there would be some listeners who would say they never dream. And there is a tiny fraction of the population, about 0.38%, that says consistently that they never dream. But there's new research that shows that perhaps even that tiny fraction is lying, and that most people dream, well, all people dream all the time. It's just that they don't remember them.
Yeah, it's gone too quickly. Well, Richard Feynman was another famous physicist, actually, who studied dreaming and sleeping. And he actually just sort of sat in rooms, and he wanted to study the process of falling asleep. So he'd just sit in a room and wait until he fell asleep, but kind of observing himself. And he said that he managed to go through different layers, and one time got really right down to the point where he was aware that he was asleep, but he was aware that he was observing himself asleep, and, like, was super lucid dreaming. And that he would then feel that he wasn't sure he could wake up, because your body is paralyzed when you're asleep. So he was kind of aware that he was paralyzed because he hadn't got awake enough, but he was alert enough to realize it. And he'd have to have, like, stern talks with himself, telling himself, there is no disease I know of where a person falls asleep naturally and can't wake up. You can always wake up. And after talking to myself many times like that, I became less and less afraid. I found the process of waking up rather thrilling, something like a roller coaster. I mean, I do wish I found my daily alarm rather thrilling, but I don't. But there we go. Maybe if you crack lucid dreaming, you too can enjoy the thrills of waking up. We've been asking you to tweet us, what do you think are the most relaxing songs? Amna, what have we got?
So we've got from Yasmin Galbraith, and her relaxing song is The Fugees, Ready or Not. I don't think it's very relaxed. I think that's a good song to dance to.
Yeah, it's like pumping you up, yeah. Getting you going.
Someone else who just goes by MJ said that he enjoys listening to Michael Garra's Swans. I'm not sure what that is, but it's a song that he can sleep to.
Can't say I've ever heard of it either.
Me
either. There's a girl at my university that used to listen to whale songs, like, to help her go to sleep. And so the British Academy of Sound Therapy performed some tests back in 2011 after they declared that, I think I'm going to now reveal, what they thought the most relaxing song ever was Weightless by Marconi Union. And they tested the ability of the song to sort of slow the heart rate and the blood pressure and decrease levels of cortisol, that's your stress hormone. I want to say that they only tested it in 40 women. I don't know why it was only women, and 40 is quite a small sample, but apparently this song was more effective at reducing their feelings of stress and inducing relaxation than either Enya, Mozart, Coldplay, or even having a massage. Crazy. And it's all to do, they say, with the fact that the continuous rhythm of this song is at 60 beats per minute, and both your brain waves and your heart rate sort of synchronize to this rhythm, which is a process known as entrainment. And this is meant to be very calming on the body. And they also say things like the underlying bass tones relax the listener, and there's a sort of whooshing trance-like quality that takes you out of yourself into a deeper state of calm. I mean, did the song that you used to listen to have any of those qualities?
I don't know. Maybe I should go back and analyze whether there was any entrainment in Max Richter's songs, but I definitely know that there was perhaps my heart rate matching the
yeah.
beat rate, perhaps.
Brilliant. Well, this is what we're going to play out on. This is Weightless by Marconi Union. And I have to say, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely fascinating. I could talk about sleep all day, and I'm almost inspired to try one of these polyphasic schedules myself.
One day.
One day. One day. Thank you, and goodbye.